be the worst. Cleanse your palate before you quench your thirst.
Beers of Alaska.
I'm going to steal Bill's thunder here for just a moment. This is Jenny again, and I wanted to let you know that during Drinking on the Last Frontier here live with Bill Howell and Zach Henry, we have an extra raffle prize to give away. Bill brought in a copy of his book, Alaska Beer, Liquid Gold in the Land of the Midnight Sun. So we are going to add that to the prizes for this next hour. So if you give us a call, 907-513-1996, that book could be yours. All right, over to Bill.
Hello and welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.net, a listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. And as a very special guest today, I have my very good friend, Mr. Zach Henry, owner/brewer of St. Elias Brewing Company in Soul.net. How are you doing today, Zach?
I'm doing good, Bill.
So, appreciate you coming in with us. So, you folks out there listening, if you've got questions or you want to make a donation, you call 907-513-1996. So as we get started, I've got something I want to talk about with Zach, which is the latest development with the implementation of the new state liquor laws. Some of you may have seen the article in the Clarion a few days ago, mentioning how the state has delegated 20 restaurant eating place licenses to Soldotna, the city of Soldotna, that they can now award those without having to go through the state board. So what are your thoughts on that? And you think this is going to work out better than I certainly do, but what do you think about it, Zach?
Well, I mean, considering, I guess, the population of Soldotna and then, you know, all the communities that surround Soldotna, that, you know, people that use Soldotna, you know, it kind of, I guess, makes sense to me that they could offer more of those. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, it would seem to me that it's always better if the lower level of government is making the call, considering they probably have a better idea of exactly what's needed in Soldotna and the surrounding area than the state board down in Juneau trying to decide, yeah, should we have another restaurant that could serve beer and wine in Soldotna? So I'm assuming that this is going to facilitate the plan that Doug Hoag has at Kenai River Brewing to convert to a restaurant eating place license instead of his brewery taproom license, which will open up some new opportunities for as far as serving different beers and not being as limited as he is now. So I was actually hoping to catch up with Doug yesterday to ask him about that, but I didn't. So I'm going to speculate here on the radio without talking to him. So because that's basically how you guys are operating now, right?
Right.
Because your brew pub license went away, and so you're basically a brewery with a restaurant eating place license now.
Right, correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it'd be definitely be good for them because there'd be a lot less constraints. I mean, as far as bar stools at the bar and, you know, special events and all that kind of stuff, though, kind of opens it up a bit for them.
So did the new changes open anything up for you? Are you allowed to do anything new now that you weren't before the 1st of January?
Yeah, we have the ability now to distribute if we want to. So that's kind of on the table. I don't necessarily know that we're going to do that, but it's nice to know that you can if you want to.
And you're allowed to distribute, like, what, 1,000 barrels or something like that?
I can't remember. It's something like that, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not really set up. I mean, our whole model is truly a brew pub model and not really set up for mass marketing, but it's nice to know that you can do it if you ever decide to head that direction with your business.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, you could have your cans for sale somewhere elsewhere. Else in town if you wanted to or something sure. like that.
Yep. So,
well, cool. It's cool. So, again, we're here at 907-513-1996. Give us a call if you got any questions for me or Zach or you want to make a donation. Otherwise, we're just going to sit up here and babble back and forth about stuff that's going on. So, so what are you guys up to these days at the brewery? You got anything new, spectacular coming out anytime soon? Anything you want to plug here for the public?
Well, currently just kind of getting ready for summer. We know that it's coming here. It's kind of the calm before the storm, but I kind of get into mass production mode during the summertime, just making sure I keep all my tanks full to, you know, feed all the thirsty travelers. But yeah, we've got I did a collaboration. I've been doing a lot of collaborations actually with like different businesses, which has been kind of fun, you know, do one with Houston Morris of Industrial Pumps of Alaska. And we have a rotating IPA that we do, and it keeps it fun for me because I'm able to experiment, try some new things, learn something. Yesterday I brewed a beer with Jimmy Jack, Fishing Lodge. He has a charter and Fishing Lodge. And so he wanted to do an amber. I ended up going with a Scottish style ale. Probably going to be around like 5%, something like that. Used a Scottish strain, which is kind of fun. I've actually not really messed around with that strain of yeast yet, so that's kind of cool. So hopefully here in the next 3 weeks we'll have that beer out.
You use White Labs 28 or something else?
Well, I use BSI. It's Brewing Science Institute, and it's the same. It's the 028. Yep. So okay. I think, is that the McEwen's?
Yeah, I think it is. They call Edinburgh. White Labs calls it Edinburgh Ale Yeast.
Yeah, but, yep.
So, yeah, that's a good, that's the one I use to make that strong scotch that I gave you the bottle of a couple of weeks ago.
Was that strain. That was a dang good beer.
Yeah, it's a good yeast strain.
Did you ferment that cool? Because there's a pretty wide range of fermentation with that. I was looking at that yeast.
I think I fermented it at about 67 Fahrenheit and then dropped it to 55 for about 6 weeks.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
For cold condition.
Yeah, I was just reading about it, and it said the fermentation range was between like 50 and 70, and I thought that was interesting. You know, typically ales, you're fermenting a little warmer than, you know, 50. Yeah. That's pretty low.
Yeah, well, that's what I, like I said, 67 for the first week and then dropped it.
Gotcha. So, cool.
Now that I finally have a brewing equipment that I can control the temperature a little bit with.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. So, question now. I was just thinking back for a few years ago. You have pretty much gotten rid of all of your barrels, right? Your wooden barrels, casks that you had laying around for so long.
Yeah, I kind of got into that for a little while when we first started. I had, I don't know, gosh, probably 20 of them back there and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And then seemed like I started needing that space a little more and more, and then started kicking them out. But I don't know, maybe one of these days I'll get a couple more and find a spot in the brewery I can put a rack or something. And
yeah, well, like I said, I remember when you were making your lambic styles. And
yeah, that was fun.
We made that Brett Pale Ale once where we let it sit in the barrel for like a year.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's wood is really fun. It's hard to wrap your mind around the science. Sometimes it's just kind of does what it wants to do, and that's kind of fun, I guess.
Yeah, cool. So how about a call in from you folks out there at 907-513-1996. If you guys have any questions for Zach or I, or you can send them to Facebook or email to the station here.
info@kdll.org. And we actually did just get a Facebook question.
Oh, go for it.
For Zach, but I'm sure, Bill, you can speak to this too. This is from Jess. So Jess wants to know, from a brewer's point of view, what do you think is the best beer festival in Alaska, and what makes a good festival for the brewers as opposed to the attendants?
Ooh, this is a tough one. You don't go to brewers festivals as much as you used to. So.
Yeah, we used to hit like all of them, and now we've kind of just gone down to bare bones, just the local ones. The Frozen River Fest is pretty stinking cool, I think. That's one of my favorites, but In the past, we've gone to the Haynes Festival, and that was pretty memorable. I mean, it, just for one, it's absolutely gorgeous. Like the, it's a long drive down, but man, it is pretty, and then just neat. Like trying a lot of beers from breweries that you don't get to sample very often that are further away. So probably in my mind, that one's probably my favorite. But I think the Frozen River is pretty special too.
I'd say the Frozen River is definitely the most unique.
Yep.
Nobody else is doing anything like that. And obviously our local Rotary Festival is a very nice festival.
Yeah, that one's good.
But I'd have to give high marks to the Haynes Fest as well, but for just the reasons that you cited, which is you get – there's breweries that go to that festival that really don't go to anything outside of Southeast.
Yeah.
So if you want to take 2 days and drive down to Haynes, you can – sample breweries from the Yukon and from, you know, Juneau and Ketchikan and places like that that you just don't see here in the South Central. So it's
they have a pretty nice beer dinner there too. That's pretty cool, where they pair different beers with different foods, and that's pretty neat.
Oh yeah, that was going to happen in like 2 weeks from today. So if anybody. It may be sold out by now. I haven't checked it recently, but it does all sell out pretty quick down there in Haynes. So that's a nice one. But as I said, we're really blessed here in Soldotna to have a couple of really good festivals locally, you know, and I have heard a lot of brewers say that they really do enjoy coming to the Frozen River Fest, that they think that one's a lot of fun and something that they very much enjoy. So maybe not quite as much as in the old days when they used to trash a bread and breakfast every time they came down.
Right.
I can remember those days,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
So we have a slightly tamer crop of brewers now than we had 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a good question. If you have one, send it to us on Facebook or give us a call. We'll be happy to take a stab at it. Let me ask you another question. We were just discussing before we came in here about non-alcoholic beers and hard seltzers, these kind of, I guess I would call them beer adjacent things that a lot of people are starting to make. What's your take on that? Have you ever tried? I mean, you're not really set up to make a non-alcoholic beer, but I guess in theory you could make a hard seltzer. Have you ever made anything like that? What do you think about them?
No, I'm kind of hesitant to jump on that bandwagon. I can't ever help myself if I see a cooler and there's a bunch of seltzers in there and there's a beer next to it. I go for the beer. The seltzer thing, I don't know if it's in my DNA or what, but I'm not a big fan. Just not a lot of flavor, I guess. I like the flavor of fermented barley and hops. As far as non-alcoholic beer, I don't really have the setup to be able to do that, and it's fairly expensive equipment. I think Kenai Rivers, they've got a system where they can remove the alcohol, which is kind of a cool idea, or you can take that alcohol and put it into something else and then sell the non-alcoholic beer. But as far as the flavor of non-alcoholic beer, you never really feel like you're drinking a beer, but it kind of tastes a little bit like a beer, but it doesn't have the, I don't know, the body, the alcohol being part of the flavor components.
They're definitely getting better, because I can remember non-alcoholic beers from years and years ago that were just absolutely terrible,
right.
Like no flavor. So
near beer.
They're getting closer to it, but. It does, to me, there always does seem to be just something missing. But
yeah.
I guess if you were in a situation where you wanted to drink beer adjacent, but you didn't want to drink alcohol, there's something to be argued for it. But it's an interesting trend, you know, looking not even just locally, just looking at the bigger beer world. You see so many breweries that are kind of branching out into different areas. I would assume, because they're trying to help the bottom line in the sense that, without giving too much away, how's your guys' business doing, you know, compared to, say, 5 years ago, pre-COVID or whatever? Are you guys back where you were further along? How do you, you know, how would you assess the health of the craft beer business?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing good. I definitely can't complain. Since COVID, I guess there's been some challenges with just finding reliable help and people that want to work. That's kind of a tough one. Specifically, you know, we have a kitchen and we were hiring a lot of younger people to run that. And I don't know, I guess to think about my own dad saying kids these days, but I don't know. It's a definitely a different generation of kids, but.
Well, that's on the
food side.
That's on
yeah.
the help food side.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you seeing as far as on the sales side? You know, are you guys back where you were before COVID, or how are you?
Yeah. I'd say we're pretty steady right now. Okay. I mean, there's always ups and downs. It seems like every year, and as long as you're hopefully over time trending up a little bit, you know, you're doing something right.
Well, I mean, I was just looking. I think I reported on it last month about the nationwide numbers, right, from the Brewers Association about brewery openings, mm-hmm. brewery closings, still moving slightly in the positive direction in the sense that more open than closed.
Sure.
But, like, volume is down slightly. You know, mm-hmm. it's been down for the last few years. So the trend lines that pretty much pre-COVID or, you mm-hmm. know, in the teens, the mm-hmm. 2010s were all, you know, in a distinct upward direction, right?
Yeah.
We're making more, where breweries are opening, everybody's selling more beer, everything is go, go, go. That definitely seems to have flattened out
mm-hmm.
and if not, maybe even turned slightly negative.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what do you think? Have we just hit market saturation as far as that?
I don't know. I honestly see a heck of a lot of people drinking like White Claws and I mean something that didn't really exist, at least to my knowledge, too far before COVID. But I think that there's definitely been a shift. A lot of people thinking more about calories and things like that, moving to seltzers or you're seeing now a lot of distilleries are mixing drinks that in a can, you know, something you didn't see a lot of before. It's becoming more and more popular, but I'm not sure if they've kind of stole some of that market or not. But
yeah, well, definitely, I guess the comparison I've seen is young people are drinking a lot more spirits than they were. So there's the appetite seems to be moving in that direction, unfortunately, away from beer, mm-hmm. more towards wine, spirits.
Yeah,
you know, White Claws, as you say, you know, hard seltzers and these other things that aren't exactly mm-hmm. beer, certainly not craft beer, whatever you want to call them, however you want to draw the box. I don't think they would fall into craft beer.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it seems like a lot of new beer drinkers, too, are always looking for the next thing that's out, the next big thing. And I read an article about. It was like the death of the flagship beer, you know, where a lot of these companies that relied on, you know, that one beer that was their flagship, like declining sales and the consumers wanting what's new, you know, just the latest, greatest thing.
Who would have thought we wouldn't see Anchor Steam around anymore?
Yeah, I know,
you
it's
know?
Sad.
Things like that for icons that are like disappearing.
Even like Fat Tire, I've tried that recently and I was looking at it. It's like, man, that doesn't look the same. And I tasted it. It tasted good, but it's different than it was. And I kind of looked it up and now it's like, it's its own company. Like I think it was like Fat Tire Brewing Company or something like that. And it's totally sold and totally changed. And I mean, there's a few different beers that I've had recently that they're not like they were before. They've reformulated like the Boston Lager, you know, if you look at it now, it says remastered on the front. It's changed.
Yeah.
Not necessarily saying good or bad, but
different.
I guess the breweries are trying to appeal to the tastes of the consumer.
That's amazing when you think about, you know, the idea that there's breweries out there in like Britain and places like that have been in business for hundreds of years and basically not.
Never changed.
Identical to what they were making 100 years ago, but
sure.
recognizable, you know. Yeah. And yet here we have breweries we can't keep the same, can't keep making the same stuff for 5 years.
Right.
You know, we have to change. Because like you say, so many people are looking for the next big thing.
So. Oh, and the hazies have just like overtaken the market.
Oh, let's not get started on that. I mean, like I said, no, you weren't there at that beer festival. Clark Pels was at the January festival, and he was wearing a cap, and it was red, and it had white printing on it. But what it said was, make IPAs clear again.
That's awesome.
So he could have sold 100 of them, I think, if he'd have had them, because I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a little awkward, but I actually have an IPA question for
you.
Sure,
go for it.
Interesting timing. All right, so from Melissa, her husband is very into craft beer, and she's trying to get more into craft beer. He loves IPAs, but she is confused because there's a million of them, and she doesn't know what she's going to get when she orders them. So Melissa's question is, can you demystify IPAs?
You want to take a stab at that one?
Well, one thing I was going to point out, and maybe this is the reason why the hazy IPAs are so popular, is they're not the IPAs of past. You know, in the past, the IPAs, you know, 20 years ago were like, you knew there were hops in there. It was bitter. And a lot of these newer hazy IPAs are much smoother. It's more about hop flavor than bitterness. And so that might be kind of what appeals to some people that are just getting into the world of hops. But
I guess I would say that these days IPAs definitely fall into various categories. So if you walk into a place and you just ask for an IPA, it's practically the same as walking in and saying, give me a beer, in the sense that there's so many different types of IPAs out there. The classic ones that obviously Zach and I remember would be something that's close to today's West Coast IPAs, which are typically clear, fairly bitter, and are hopped with a lot of West Coast, the sea hops like Centennial and Chinook and stuff like that, that have a kind of piney, resiny, some people would say dank flavor profile to them. Then there's the New England IPAs, which we're sitting here making fun of, that tend to look like orange juice in a glass because they are so cloudy and hazy and are typically hopped with more exotic varieties, shall we say, things from like Australia, New Zealand, and new versions that have much more tropical fruit flavor notes, kind of like Juicy Fruit gum is what they always taste like to me, if anybody out there still remembers chewing Juicy Fruit gum. And, you know, and again, you can tell them in the glass because they're typically, they almost look like orange juice. They're really, really cloudy, really, really hazy. So those are kind of the two big families of IPAs out there. So obviously, before you order an IPA, you should be able to ask whoever the server is and say, you know, what kind of an IPA are we dealing with when you say this is an IPA? And then once you get those two major groups, there's kind of a whole bunch of smaller groups. I was drinking last night something called a session IPA, which is, I think we used to call a pale ale, right, Zach?
Mm-hmm.
Which in the sense of it's not as strong or overwhelming. It's a little less alcoholic or hoppy than an IPA would be, not as bitter, designed so that you can drink more than one without it stripping the enamel off your teeth or anything like that. And then once you get beyond that, there's a million other things that people will slap the IPA label on. There's black IPAs, white IPAs, red IPAs,
brute IPA,
cold IPAs, you know. I've seen all these different things where the problem is IPA has turned into such a generic name, it doesn't really mean anything anymore. It's like a synonym for craft beer, you know. I mean, black IPA, I think we used to call those hoppy porters
right
back in the day, you know. So I don't know. Well, other thoughts?
There's the IPL, the India Pale Lager now.
Now use a lager yeast, make it. Yeah. So it's, I mean, on one hand, it's great because people are being very inventive and experimentative and things like that. But on the other hand, there's words don't mean anything anymore. Names don't mean anything. You know, it's the same thing when somebody says, oh, I'm going to brew a Belgian barley wine. Well, they don't brew barley wines in Belgium. What are you talking about? Oh, I'm going to brew a barley wine, English barley wine, but I'm going to use a Belgian yeast. Or I'm going to brew an American barley wine, but I'm going to use a Belgian yeast. So we're mashing up all these terms.
Yeah.
And we almost get to the point now where you don't, it doesn't, stylistically, things don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, so. one brewery's India Black, whatever they call that, IPA, Black IPA, could be another brewery's porter, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between porters and stout.
Mm-hmm.
What makes something a porter or stout? What the brewer called it when they made it.
Right.
So, I mean, or let's say the difference between Henry's Best Bitter and Jabberwocky. Okay? You want to tell the people the story behind that one?
Yeah, that was a beer that Bill and I made. It was an English bitter, and it was a really, really good beer. I mean, both of us were quite happy with it. But we called it Henry's Best Bitter, and
couldn't give it away.
Yeah, it just didn't sell very well. Like, people don't like the term bitter, you know. But then I made it again, just like, man, I know this beer is good. Like, well, maybe I should rename it. So I renamed it Jabberwocky, and then it was selling like hotcakes. So it's just kind of funny. It's all kind of in the name. But
but again, that's the thing with terminology and marketing and all that sort of stuff. So unfortunately, Melissa, I'm not sure that I can give you a really good guide other than to ask and try and get the server to describe the beer to you so you can figure out what does that mean. So, but there's like the cartoon I've seen where the guy walks into a bar and says, what do you got on? And the guy says, we got this brand new ESB. It's pretty good. And he says, I don't like bitter beer. Give me an IPA.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's some pretty good commercial ones that like on the market too, like you could try like the one from Fremont. Have you ever had the Lush IPA?
Yeah.
It's a pretty nice, pretty good beer. I would try that one.
Yeah. The one I would recommend, besides Zach's, of course, is Denali's Twister Creek. To me, it has a very floral IPA that's kind of reminiscent of some of the stuff that I had in Britain.
Yeah.
The hops are different, but the sort of profile that they use, it's not over-the-top bitter or anything like that. So, if you've got any questions for us or you'd like to make a donation, please call 907-513-1996. So,
I have two others that have come in if you want to take another question. So do you want a history question or a style question?
Well, Bill, you're the history buff
here. Okay, give us a history question.
Okay, so this is kind of a two-parter. Their first one is a bit of a trivia challenge. Mm-hmm. So what is the history of Cascade hops? Do you guys know how Cascade hops came about?
Well, that's getting down in the weeds for me a little bit. I mean, Cascades have been around for quite a while, and if memory serves, Cluster were the original C hop. Is that what you remember?
Yeah, I was thinking it was some variation of Fuggle or something like that, but I may be wrong.
I'm not sure what the root variant for Cascades were, because back in the dark ages, like the early 80s, mm-hmm. when they first started making pale ale, like Sierra Nevada pale ale and stuff, I think Cluster was like the only real American hop that they were using. So, but then they started developing the different varieties off of that, all the C hops like Centennial and Cascade and Chinook and those guys. But Cascade is one of the classic Pac Northwest hops, so it's going to have that sort of piney, resiny, dank. It was used in a lot of the early versions. If I'm recalling correctly, Bert Grant used Cascades in a lot of his beers from Yakima, again, in the mid to late 80s, stuff like that. So, but I mean, I don't remember the exact
What was that first IPA that came out? It was like in the, you know what I'm talking about? It was in
the
70s.
Bert Grant brewed an India Pale Ale at his brew pub. He brewed that. He brewed a Scottish. He brewed a Imperial Stout kind of a thing using American hops and things like that. And then there was Anchor Steam, Anchor Brewing, did the Liberty Ale.
Right.
And they used a lot of Cascades and Chinooks. A lot of people say they were the first American IPA because they brewed that in 75 for the anniversary of Paul Revere's ride,
right.
200th anniversary. So that's another one that was well hopped with, particularly for the time, with Cascades and
stuff. And that was
like
labeled
that.
A pale ale, wasn't it? But it really is
an
IPA?
Yeah, they just called it Liberty Ale. They didn't call it an IPA or anything. But it in retrospect, a lot of people looked at that and said, wow, that was like one of the first American IPAs out there.
Right.
All right. Well, we've danced around that for a while. What's the style question?
Well, so you guys did very good on that. This was a question from Dan. He sent an article along with it to fact check. So you were correct that it came from the cluster hops. Zach is correct that it was bred from English Fuggle and Russian. I'm going to get this wrong. Sarah Brinneker? Is that ringing any bells for you guys? So the part of the question that Dan was wondering if you would get is apparently developing the Cascade hops was a project of the USDA. So after Prohibition, they wanted to expand the brewing industry. And so this was handled through Oregon State University, specifically through the USDA was funding this research. And
see, there's an advantage to that in the sense that things that are developed by the government at government expense are not proprietary. Like some of the newer hop strains that are being developed by individual hop companies, basically, like Hop Union and things like that, some of those strains are proprietary, so you have to buy them from them and pay their price for it, whereas obviously strains that are developed by the public, but you know, public expense, are property of the public, so anybody can grow them. So that was another nice thing about Cascades is that they were available to anybody who wanted to farm them.
Right. Yep. So in 72, apparently, they USDA made that available for anyone that wanted to take Cascade and run with it. So Dan's kind of follow-up question, given all of that, is can you guys ever see a scenario where Alaska has kind of a larger scale commercial, you know, like specialized hop variety, some sort of Alaska, maybe with USDA support?
Well, you've played around with that to a certain degree.
Yeah, we actually have a beer on right now where we harvested hops from Frank Donham in Sterling has a farm, Timberline Farms, and he grows hops. And they pretty much took over his hoop houses, and we go out there and spend, you know, a few days picking hops, you know, drying them. By the time we're done, we've got, you know, we had, I don't know, 20 people out there picking and over the course of a couple of days and drying. And then you weigh them out and then you get about 8 pounds, you know, and it's like market value. Like right now for hops, like if you're, I don't know, $5 a pound or something, it puts it into perspective. It's definitely a labor of love, but I think it would be pretty hard to convince somebody to, unless they were just going gigantic and had a lot of equipment to be able to deal with.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that you know, you would need such a huge, because again, he's growing them indoors, basically.
Yeah.
You'd need such a huge operation to produce amounts. I kind of would draw the analogy to like growing hot peppers. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I can grow hot peppers in my greenhouse, but I can't grow enough hot peppers to make more than, you know, a few batches even over the entire course of a summer. So I don't think we're ever going to see, well, I don't know. I know, not even then. I don't think we're ever going to see commercial hop farming in Alaska. I don't see
barley, maybe.
That's what I was just going to say. I don't see any reason why we couldn't grow barley up here, brewer grade barley, if we had a place to malt it.
Yeah,
it's kind of a chicken and an egg problem in that nobody wants to grow beer quality or malt quality barley if they don't have anywhere to malt it.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's going to build a maltings if nobody's growing
right.
brew quality, beer quality, or, you know, malt quality mm-hmm. barley. So, but from a climate standpoint, I mm-hmm. don't see any reason why we couldn't be growing barley in mm-hmm. Delta Junction
yep.
That we would be using to brew our beers with and everything like that. So, I mean, there's small maltings starting to open up all over the lower 48 now. I mean, they got them mm-hmm. in Maine and
yep.
everywhere. So if anybody's listening out there that's got a few million dollars you want to invest, go for it. Malting, open up a maltings. You know, Zach will buy your product. So
I'm
sure he'd rather pay to have it trucked over from Delta Junction than shipped up from the lower 48 on at Jones Act
mm-hmm.
shipping rates.
Right.
So there's definitely a market there. Or better yet, you know, this could be another Alaska boondoggle. The state's wasted thousands and millions of dollars on previous boondoggles. So, and if you read my book, you can see they tried this boondoggle once before back in the 80s or the late 70s, where we were going to have the great barley business, and we bought train cars and had a terminal and everything else, and like so many Alaska boondoggles, it didn't work. So.
Well, there does seem to be a lot more interest in investment in, you know, local food and local agriculture, so I don't maybe the time's right, maybe there's a grower out there that wants to go that route.
You know, again, take my beer hat off and put my farmer's market hat on and talk about food resiliency and, mm-hmm. you know, the importance of having more food of any kind grown in Alaska as opposed to having 95% of it shipped in from outside. You know, there's definitely an area that where growth could be had there.
So. Yeah, well, Bill, you always talk about, you know, especially throughout history, the model of, I forget the term for it, but like your local neighborhood craft brewery and... I mean, you look at Kodiak, and they don't yeah. really ship out. It's just
like
kind of a localized
market. I like to think of it as the beer as bakery. The brewery
that's,
is bakery
yeah,
model.
That's what it
that's
is.
How Ben Milstein and Kodiak refers to it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you guys are like that in the sense that your market is Soldotna.
Right.
You're not packaging it and trying to ship it to Anchorage or anybody like that. Ben out on the rock, his market is Kodiak. He doesn't send it anywhere else.
Right.
Paul Wheeler and Haynes. His market is Haynes. You
right.
know, he's maybe sends a few kegs down to Juneau occasionally, mm-hmm. but, you know, or Homer Brewing and Homer. Those
right.
guys are, you know, and that to me is a great model
mm-hmm.
In that it's, what's the phrase I want? I don't want to say that it's not competitive, but it is, but there's room for a lot of people on that level.
Mm-hmm.
When you start moving up to the, hey, I'm going to package and I'm going to sell my stuff statewide, now you have to fight for shelf space.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much shelf space in all the liquor stores in all the state.
Right.
You know, and so whose beer is going to get bounced out to make room for yours?
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, it would be Coors Light, but that's not very likely.
Yeah.
So given the way things work. So anyway.
Well, similar, like you're saying, like, you know, you ship bread up here from Washington or Wisconsin or something versus going to your local bakery where it was just made right. like the day before or, you know, or that day. It's always going to taste better. I feel like beer is kind of the same thing. It's you get it while it's fresh, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's why I would say you got the best pilsner in Alaska. Why? Because it's the freshest pilsner I can get in Alaska. It's going to taste better
yeah.
than something that's come from the lower 48 or Europe in a can. You know, just that's just the way it is. Things, that's how chemistry works.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff deteriorates over time.
Yep.
So speaking of that, have you got any new, you were mentioned about your collaboratory brews.
Mm-hmm.
Have you got any thoughts or plans or ideas about making any changes to your long-term lineup, your flagship lineup? I mean, the last significant change I saw there was when you replaced the Kolsch with the Pilsner.
Mm-hmm.
Yay. Good job.
Right.
So
I still get people squealing about that one. It's like,
are there still people out there wanting even keel?
Yeah, I mean, no matter what, like if you make a beer that you're like maybe possibly like the least proud of, you know, that you've ever made, you'll have somebody out there that's like,
well,
that's the
I
best
know what
one
that,
I've ever
I know
had.
What that beer is.
Yeah.
That's Island Girl. So
that one actually is pretty popular.
I know it's popular,
I can't
but I can't believe
away.
You're proud of that beer. Scott
well,
Jack.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's all the compliments. Maybe it's.
So, but, you know, so.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, I think I'm kind of sticking with what I have right now for my lineup. But then, you know, just throwing in the seasonals, that's the most fun for me too. Just having, I don't want to add any more year-round beers because then that takes away from my seasonal beers. Right. That, you know.
Well, I guess the question I was asking, is there any of your year-rounds that you feel like demand is falling off on that maybe you're thinking about, maybe I need to replace this with something else?
Yeah,
I mean, are they all still really popular? People
yes.
are ordering the Mother's Milk, and they were ordering the Willowall. And
yeah, definitely like the Stout would probably be my lowest seller throughout the winter. But then there's people that come in, and that's all they drink, you know. And so I feel bad taking that away. I want to have like a pretty big spread of different styles that can appeal to a lot of different people. But
they kind of got to have a dark beer.
You
kind of dark beer.
Well, and then in the summertime, everything flips on its head, and like the beers that weren't popular are now really popular because you're getting people with different tastes, you know, coming from out of state that are used to, you know, different beers. So it's, so far I'm holding steady.
Okay. Well, like I said, maybe there's some even keel people out there, but
yeah.
I still say that Czech Pilsner is
that's my favorite too.
Outstanding.
It's my go-to.
Yeah. So.
Yep.
I do have a style question for you guys, if you're ready for that.
Hit us.
So this is I'm getting all two-parter questions here. So this one's from Kelly. First part of the question is, Kelly was out traveling and came across a beer they'd not seen before, which is a champagne beer. What the heck is a champagne beer?
I wonder if that's like one of those brut beers that they talk about. So...
Yeah, I don't
unless it was Miller High Life, the champagne of beers. I've heard of that. So,
well, I was trying to look it up. They said they were in Bloomington, and there is a brewery, Upland Brewing, and they have something called a Champagne Velvet.
Champagne Velvet.
Which, and it's talking about like effervescence and.
Well, it would suggest to me. Well, I can see a couple of possibilities. Possibility one is they could be making it the method de champagne, right? Where they do the degorgement. The way that they actually make champagne, real champagne, is after it's fermented, they put the bottles upside down and they turn them and they let them sit upside down for a couple of weeks. And it makes all the yeast go into the neck of the bottle. And then they actually uncork it, let the yeast come out, and then recork it.
Yeah,
it's called degorgement or something like that in French.
Yeah.
And it produces a very clear, effervescent product, like champagne is supposed to be. Midnight Sun did that with a batch of Jupiter, I think it was called, back in their Planet series back in 2009. Mm-hmm. 2009. But then the other option would be doing something like with
champagne yeast,
champagne yeast or something that's going to really dry the beer out, like kind of like a brut beer, and get it where it's very, very dry and very, very effervescent. So I could see either of those two possibilities for something that you would call a champagne beer. Most people don't want to mess with the method de champagne because it's very labor intensive.
Yeah, from what I remember talking to Gabe when he did that, they did what you said. They spun the bottles and daily, and they had them inverted, and they put them in dry ice.
Right.
So it actually froze
the
plug.
Freeze seal on them. Yeah.
So then they could pop the thing open, and it slowly work out the yeast and shoot out, and then they shut it.
Yeah,
but it sounds like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but I mean, obviously, it produces that, and that's like some of those Belgian styles, like Deus and stuff like that, are made that way.
Yeah,
very spendy, like $30 a bottle beers you're going to pay. But so I don't know. I guess if it was, it would have to be bottled if it was Method D champagne. If it was on draft, it must be that they're using like some sort of champagne yeast or something that's going to really dry out the beer and eat all the, you know, maybe they're using some enzymes in it to also kind of the way they make light beer to eat up, so it, the yeast can eat up all the non-fermentables, like it really, really dry.
Or maybe it's just the appearance of the beer, like maybe it's just
maybe it just looks really good, like a champagne.
Lots of carbonation.
Yeah, carbonation and nice head on it and everything. So, I don't know. That's a good question. So
from all I have is this one brewery that I found in Indiana. I don't know if this is where Kelly saw it or not, but apparently they call their beer the beer with the $1 million flavor. And this is from a brewery that's been around forever. Their great grandparents apparently had this recipe, which at one point they actually insured with a $1 million policy. So apparently very popular in Indiana. So Kelly's second part of this question, which I will get to in just a moment. I just want to remind folks that it's, we've got 10 minutes till the top of the hour. So if you want to be in our next raffle drawing, make sure to give us a call, 907-513-1996. You can also donate online at kdll.org. All right, part two for you guys. So Kelly did not snag one of these and bring them back, but was wondering, what are your top picks for if you're, if you see a beer somewhere in your travels, what's worth picking up and bringing home, and what it, do some beers travel better than others, or some, are you looking for something like rare and hard to find, or is it just a personal favorite, or like what qualifies for you if you're going to go to the effort of bringing beer back on your travels, what are you going to bring?
Yeah, I mean, the beer market has changed so much that like when I go, you know, to the lower 48, I don't recognize, you know, even a quarter of the breweries out there. So it's the first time I've ever tried these beers. You know, it used to be like, you know, 20 or 25 years ago where it's like, you knew all the major breweries that had really good, followings, and you'd kind of seek out these beers that you would read about, you know, Pliny the Elder and, you know, things like from Russian River, you know, typically, I guess if I try a beer that I really like, I will buy it and bring it back. But normally, something a little bigger, maybe that'll hold up, like a, you know, 9, 10, 11% beer, something that you could cellar and kind of keep its freshness and or its flavor, I guess.
I think I fall into two categories. Category one is personal favorites that I can't get in Alaska. So like whenever I go down to visit my daughter in Seattle, I am coming back with several bottles of St. Bernardus Abbott 12, which I think is this phenomenal beer that I've been drinking for decades that doesn't get distributed in Alaska. So there's those beers that fall into that category, like old favorites that I only can get when I'm out of state. And then the other stuff that I will bring back is if I happen to visit an interesting brewery that is packaging their beer in something like a can that I can get it, or is doing a growler or something like that, I'd like to bring a couple back for the local beer club that we're going, you know, something that I think that would be interesting for the other members of the club to sample. 5 years ago, I was in New Orleans, and there was a little brewery that just happened to be relatively close to where I was staying called the Brew Carré, which is a play on the name of the French Quarter, the Vieux Carré, and went in there, and they happened to have a really good Saison that I thought, tried it. And I was like, man, that is really, really good. And saw that they had crowlers, and I was like, okay, give me a can of that. I'm going to bring that back with me so I can share it with the beer club. So that's kind of my two that I look at, but I'd agree with Zach. If it's something for me, I'm typically going to go for the heavy side, strength-wise. Like the Abbott 12 is like a 10 or 11% alcohol. because those beers are going to cellar better, age better, keep better, you know, rather than something lower alcohol. If I'm going to go to the trouble to bring that home, it's going to be something that I'm going to drink really quick that I'm going to share with other people. So, but yeah, you know, why not bring the beer home? So,
do you have to, are there regulations or do you have to worry at all about like flying with or can't mail, right? So,
no, you not legally.
Well,
you can't sell alcohol through they keep wanting to change that law. Because the U.S. Post Office knows they're losing money to UPS and FedEx. But there's no prohibition against bringing alcohol in your checked bags.
Yeah, probably not carry-on. Don't
yeah,
try that.
You're not going to get it through on carry-on. But
Unless it's for sale in the airport.
Yeah, unless you get it at the duty-free. But there's various companies out there that will be happy to sell you these things. I use one that's called Wine Diaper, and it's
not
actually
the most appealing name.
Not the most appealing name, but it gets its name because it uses diaper material inside a plastic bag so that you seal up. So it's designed to cushion the beer, and if you should happen to break a bottle, it will absorb it rather than letting it go all over your clothes.
Right.
But there's different ones out there. Obviously cans are less worrisome about breakage than bottles and things like that. But yeah, as long as you're under your weight limit, there's no prohibition about loading up a thing, you know, your suitcase with all kinds of beers to bring back. Unless you're going across, you're driving and you're crossing the Canadian border. And I don't remember what all the rules are about driving in out of Canada with how much beer you can have and things like that. But if you're on an airplane, it's not a big deal.
If you're coming back from international somewhere, is that
there's some kind of rules. But again, I think for beer, you can bring a lot. There's like limits on how much spirits you can bring in without paying a duty on it. But beer, it's pretty, I can't remember now, but because it's been a long time since I traveled internationally, but it isn't very hard. So bring something back. So share it with your friends. Tell them about the great brewery you found in Bloomington or wherever.
Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah.
Apparently. The Champagne Velvet brand beer. I'm not really trying to, we're not a paid marketer of Champagne Velvet brand beer, but that was the question. So thank you for answering that. All right, and we've got about, where are we at? We've got about 3 minutes left in this hour.
Okay. Well, one thing I will tell you folks out there listening, if you're interested in learning more about beer, we do have a local beer club that meets monthly the first Thursday of every month at the Shriners Hall on West Poppy at 6:30. Next one is going to be June 6th, I think. That's a Thursday. Come by. We're always happy to have people come and check us out. If you like what you see, you can join. I think dues are like $25 a year or something like that, $30 a year. They're not very exorbitant. People will be bringing beers by to share. And come check us out if you want to learn some more about craft beer. Some people are brewing their own. Some people are bringing in store-bought ones. So it's a good time once a month. And then obviously you should go to St. Elias Brewing and spend a lot of money on drinking Mr. Henry's professionally produced beers. So,
yeah, swing by. I'd be happy to give you a tour and show you kind of how we do things back there.
Yeah, I could show you his new brew house as opposed to his old brew house, which was a pain. His new brew house is mighty slick. So I assume you're happy with how all your new equipment is working at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. I got to say, I was in a lot better shape with the old one, though, because there's a lot more physical activity. Now it's a little more pushing buttons and stuff. So, but yeah.
All right. Well, we are just about at noon, so probably about time to wrap it up.
All right. Well, hey, again, thanks for giving us your attention, and we'll be back on our regular day and time, the last Saturday in June. Hopefully in June I'm going to have an interview with Mike Healy from Skagway Brewing Company and somebody else. So don't quite know yet, but we're always trying to have at least two interviews. So I'll see you in June.
All right. Well, thanks, Zach. Thanks, yep, Bill. Thank you. Great to have you guys, as always.
Thank you.